Genesis 39, the 37th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on September 21, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I think we can get through this fairly quickly. However, there were questions that people asked me after last time, and two of them were asked more than once, so I thought that I should make a couple comments with respect to each of them. The first question was, wasn't Tamar? Last time we talked about Judah and Tamar. And one question is, wasn't Tamar just being selfish? Wasn't she just looking out for herself? Wasn't she just looking out for number one in doing what she did? It could be that she was. And if she was, then that would be wrong. But my understanding of the passage is that we're being led to understand that she was just doing her best to do what she believed to be right, that is, to carry on the line of her deceased husband. We don't know what her motivations are. A person with self-serving motivations and a person who's trying to do right, I think, in that same situation, could have chosen that same course of action, and from the outside it would have looked the same. It's hard to know what is driving a person, but I think in the text we have the clue that we need, and that is Judah's assessment when he said, "She is more righteous than I." And I think that that's the indication that we need, that what's being described there is a woman who is trying to do what's right, who's trying to fulfill her responsibility as she understands it to be. And Judah was not. The other question was, isn't having sex with one's father-in-law just plain wrong? I mean, isn't that incestuous? And is that not a violation of God's principles, God's absolute principles? This gets tricky. I believe that good and evil are fixed things. They don't change over time. And in that sense, they are absolute. But it's very important to think clearly about where is this absoluteness, where does it reside? And what I would argue is the absoluteness does not reside in any command. It resides in God's comprehensive worldview. And that worldview, which includes principles and values, it's that worldview that has to be brought to bear on any particular circumstance to figure out what would be the right course of action and what would be the wrong course of action. And that comprehensive worldview is one that is very complex. It's one that we as human beings in this lifetime will never accurately reconstruct in our minds. And it was my observation last time, and I've pointed this out before, it does not appear to be God's intention. He doesn't seem to make it one of his goals to make sure that we can reconstruct in our minds that comprehensive worldview. He leaves us in murkiness. There is some benefit to be gained by us struggling through every situation that we come along and try to figure out What should we do? And more fundamentally, do I want to be obedient to God or do I not? And because it's so complex and so difficult to put that God's worldview together, it's very easy for other influences to be incorporated into our understanding of what is right and wrong, including cultural factors. Things that we absorb from the culture around us and we just assume to be right without ever having thought about them. And I think that's what has happened to Tamar. I don't think she's ever thought about whether the levirate marriage custom that was developed in her time is in keeping with God's worldview. I don't know whether it is or not. I don't know if God ideally would say that's the way we should deal with the problem of widows who need to be cared for or not. It's so complex, I'm not sure whether that was a good solution or not that was come up with by that culture. But she has accepted that as a value, and she's trying to live her life in conformity with that and everything else that she believes to be right. I would venture to say that we would have similar things in our conception of what is right and wrong. Let me take one example. Is adoption, the way that we do it, the best way to deal with unwanted children or orphaned children? I'm not confident that it is. I'm not confident that it's not. It's one of those difficult things. How do you accommodate children like that? There must be some way. Other cultures have done it differently. We use adoption. I don't know if that's, in the ultimate scheme of things, whether that's the wisest way to do it. But I don't think it's wrong to adopt. And it's not obviously wrong. These things get really tough. They're very difficult decisions. It's hard to sort this stuff out. God has left it that way. And we bumble along, we muddle along, and God has left us in that position of having to muddle and to sort things out constantly. And that's what she was doing. So I don't think that what she did was just plain unambiguously wrong. I think it's one of those things that's difficult to sort out. But I think she was trying to do what is right, and that's what's exemplary about her. Okay, moving on then to chapter 39. 2 weeks ago, we looked at the event in which Joseph was sold by his brothers into slavery. And the last we knew about Joseph is he was strapped to the back of some camel headed south towards Egypt. Last week, then, we looked at the story of Tamar and Judah. So there we see one of Joseph's brothers who was still in Palestine, and we saw the events that transpired with respect to him over a 22-year period of time. And that was all crammed into one chapter. And what we observed there is Judah, who had remained behind, absorbed Canaanite culture, absorbed Canaanite values, and we saw evidence had become one who was irresponsible with respect to his duties. Now we are going to look at Joseph and the events that transpired in his life during that same 22-year period of time. And that will be stretched out over three chapters. And then at the end of the three chapters, we'll see Joseph and his brothers reunited, and we'll see how that happens. Putting Judah in the last chapter and then following up with this story of Joseph provides us with quite a contrast between the two brothers. Judah, we saw in the last chapter, was characterized by irresponsibility. And we'll see here that Joseph is acting quite differently. The first six verses. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him, and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. And he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. And it came about that from the time he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned, in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him there he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. If you imagine Joseph, he's 17 years old when he's sold into slavery. And he's put on this, taken with this caravan of Ishmaelites down to Egypt. He must have been scared to death. He doesn't know what's going to happen. There's no indication that he's ever been to Egypt. He's probably heard some things about Egypt, but he's never been there. So he's going into the unknown, and he knows that he's going to be sold into slavery. So this must have been one of the low points of his life. He's taken down to Egypt, and there he is purchased by Potiphar, who is the captain of the Pharaoh's bodyguards. So he is purchased by someone who's a high-ranking official, and as we will find out, has some means. He has a certain amount of wealth. So he's fortunate, because there are lots of experiences of slavery, and he happens to be purchased by someone who is highly placed, and that turns out to be fortunate for him. He's purchased by Potiphar. He goes to work as a slave. It's not clear what he's doing initially. He may have been working out in the fields. It's not clear. But we see from the description in the chapter that by steps over a period of time, and it doesn't make it clear how long this takes, Joseph works his way up within the household of Potiphar. First, he's moved into the house. So as opposed to being a field servant, he's a house servant. And traditionally, historically, it was always much better to be a house servant than a field servant. Well, in most respects. If you're a field servant, you won't be in contact with the master, and the chances of moving up, of any kind of promotion, are quite slim. If you're inside the household, you're going to have contact with the master, and the chances of being moved up are better. The work also tends to be less menial, less laborious. So Joseph is fortunate. He gets moved into the household. The drawback of moving into the household is that you have the potential of becoming involved in the household politics, which is exactly what happens here. He moves into the household. He gains the favor of his master. His master observes that everything he does turns out well. Joseph has the golden touch. And if things turn out well for Joseph, that's good for the master. He's going to benefit from this as well. So Potiphar puts him in charge of, he makes him first his personal attendant, and then he becomes in charge of everything that Potiphar has, both in the fields and in the household. So clearly, Joseph is Joseph is blessed by God. God's got his hands on Joseph. Even though Joseph finds himself a slave, clearly God is doing something and working through Joseph's life and around Joseph's life and has put him into a good position even though he's still a slave. Then the last verse of this section is a little bit ominous. It says Joseph was a handsome man. There's a sense in which Joseph is a little bit too blessed, that the blessing of God is going to turn out to be a source of pain for him. The next section, 7 through 18. And it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" And it came about, as she spoke to Joseph day after day, that he did not listen to her, or lie beside her, or be with her. Now it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. And she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. He came in to me and to lie with me, and I screamed. And it came about, when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, that he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside." So she left his garment beside her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with these words, "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came in to me to make sport of me. And it happened as I raised my voice and screamed that he left his garment beside me and fled outside." So Joseph becomes involved in the politics of the household. This is the drawback of being a household slave. The wife of his master becomes interested in Joseph. He's a handsome man. And she wants him to sleep with him. And when she offers this, when she suggests this, Joseph is put into a no-win situation, as you can imagine. If he complies with her request, then it is a breach of the confidence that his master has placed in him. And at the very least, his conscience will be plagued. And more than likely, sooner or later, it will be found out, and he will suffer the wrath of his master. If he declines, then he runs the risk of the wrath of his master's wife. So either way, he loses. He's caught between a rock and a hard place. Joseph declines the offer. Interestingly, he doesn't go into an explanation of, he doesn't say adultery is wrong. He uses explanations that I think he believes that she can identify with. He says, "My master has trusted me implicitly. He has trusted me with everything. I cannot violate that trust." The greater the trust, the greater would be the violation. And he couldn't have that on his conscience. He couldn't do that. Secondly, it would be a sin against God. So those are the two reasons that he gives. So here we see Joseph being very responsible in contrast to what we had seen in the last chapter, in which Judah was not responsible. Well, the wife persists. It becomes a daily, it says day after day. It becomes a frequent situation in which she invites him to sleep with her. So you can imagine Joseph's situation. How do I avoid being caught in a compromising situation? How do I discreetly avoid my master's wife? And this is going on for a period of time. It's not clear how long, but it could be a very long period of time. And he is continually declining and apparently trying to avoid even being with her alone. But then comes the fateful day. There's a day in which no one else is around. Joseph is in the house, and his master's wife becomes more aggressive. I don't know all of the psychology behind what she's doing here, but you can imagine that she would be hurt. That here is this slave in her household. She's attracted to him. She's made several offers to him, and he has declined repeatedly. She has to be thinking, what's wrong with me? Why not? Why am I not attractive to him? And it has to be an offense against her at some point. And so she becomes more desperate and more aggressive. So this time, she actually grabs onto his garment. And by the word, it's unclear what garment, but it's probably the outer clothing that she's grabbing. Not a coat, but just the outer clothing. She grabs that, and Joseph realizes he's in a tough situation, and he just leaves, and leaves his garment behind. So here she is, by herself in this part of the house, with his garment, and you can just see the wheels turning. She's thinking, I got to do something here quick. She is a fast thinker. She calls in the men from the other part of the house. And what's interesting is she kind of lobbies them. She says, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, see, he has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. She's blaming it on her husband. He has brought in, and what has he brought in? A Hebrew, a foreigner. And why? To make sport of us. It's a very interesting thing that she's saying to the men of the household. My suspicion is that Joseph, in rising from his position as a lowly slave in the household of Potiphar to the one that is implicitly in charge of absolutely everything in the household, he has possibly created some enemies, but has certainly laid the groundwork for envy. And not only was he a slave, but he was a foreigner, a Hebrew. And the term Hebrew seems to refer to a social group. Not necessarily an ethnic group, but a social group. It would be similar to what a term like gypsy. It refers to a lifestyle rather than an ethnic group. And the Hebrews were known as this kind of wandering, homeless, not particularly well-to-do social group. So it's this Hebrew that he brought into us. So what she's doing is she's planning, she's kind of inviting them in to her version of things. Now, they've worked in the household. They know what kind of woman she is. And if she was making advances towards Joseph on a regular basis, surely at least some of them had some inkling of what was going on. They are not going to be fooled by the story. But it's as if she's inviting them to agree on an account of what has occurred here as a way of getting him out of there. She's playing on their envy, and it appears to be a successful venture. So her account then, that she encourages them to buy into, is that she was in the house, he came in, wanted to rape her, and as evidence of that, she has the garment left behind, but she valiantly fought off the attacker, screamed, and he fled because he was afraid of getting caught. That's the story that she creates, and the people in the household all nod their heads in agreement. Yeah, that's what happened. The master is brought in. She tells him this version of the story, and he is apparently persuaded, at least to one degree or another. It says that his anger burned, but it doesn't say what is the object of his anger. What is that anger directed towards? We have to assume it's towards Joseph, but the fact that it doesn't say that is a little intriguing. There's another thing that's intriguing about this. He has Joseph put into jail, apparently by at least the principles of middle of the ancient Near East. He could have been put to death for what he had done. So apparently, Potiphar has asked for a lesser charge. He has just been put in prison. So one has to wonder if Potiphar is 100% convinced by his wife's story. I suspect that Potiphar is not entirely convinced of his wife's innocence. In any case, he ends up in prison. But he doesn't end up in a normal prison. Now, I don't know anything about the prison system in ancient Egypt, but the author has gone out of his way to point out that this is the prison for the king's prisoners. So presumably, this is a different prison than the other prisons. So once again, he ends up in prison, but it's not the worst of the prisons. It's not the worst situation that he could be in. And once again, we see God's favor on Joseph, even in this terrible situation. The chief jailer looks favorably upon him and begins to put him in charge of things. And once again, Joseph begins to rise in his position, even though it's within a prison now. He seems to rise in his position to a place of responsibility and authority. And he rises to the point in which all of the prisoners are put under his charge, and God makes everything that he does prosper. There are a number of things that we could talk about in this section, but the one that intrigues me the most is the one that hits most close to home. And that is, it is easy to identify with Joseph's ups and downs in this story. That Joseph was the victim of two huge injustices, two things that were not merited whatsoever. And he suffers as a result of those injustices. And you can imagine in each case, when he was sold into slavery, how horrible he must have felt, dejected, crushed, hopeless. But then he's sold into slavery and he finds himself in a better situation than he could have hoped for, really. And he starts to work his way up. So it's like those times in our lives when something horrible happens, and yet you think you can see the light at the end of the tunnel. But then, just as he's beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel, something else happens that's even more catastrophic. Another injustice, and even greater injustice. And now he's a prisoner with even less hope. And yet once again, God starts to work. I find it particularly helpful to see that this is happening over a long period of time. It is 13 years from the time that Joseph is sold into slavery to the time when he gets released from prison. It's not clear how long he was working as a slave for Potiphar and how much of that time he was in jail. He was in jail at least 2 years, but it could have been 4, 6, we don't really know. The time that he was a slave, 6, 7, even 10 years, we don't really know. But we're talking years and not months. So, if you put it into that perspective, how fast things are improving in Joseph's life as he's a slave is probably quite slow and incremental. It's really stretched out. The catastrophes are immediate. So these crushing catastrophes, and then very slowly beginning to see that God's hand is still active in his life, working behind the scenes to do with Joseph what God has planned. It's in those catastrophes that it's easy to think that things are out of control. Either God doesn't care about me, or he can't manage things. One of those things must be the case. But very slowly, God shows that he is active in Joseph's life and carrying out his purposes. But it's very slow. And then another catastrophe. And Joseph must have been right back to the same place. God either doesn't love me, or he's not in control of things. And then slowly the pieces start to come back together over years. And I suspect that all of us, in one way or another, can identify with that and the disappointments in our lives and catastrophes in our lives. And then just the subtle indications over a long period of time, and God demands a great deal of patience from us because we want things fixed in days or weeks, but he's on a whole different time schedule. It's years and decades in which he's putting things back together. And I'm sure we've all experienced that in one way or another. Okay, I have left lots of time for questions. Please feel free.
Maybe not a question, but an observation. I'm just thinking about kind of Potiphar's household, and obviously if his spouse was flirting with Joseph, at some level, she was also lying to her husband, which Potiphar kind of had a precedence probably of her not being honest with him. Probably at some level, he realized that she wasn't being honest. And he had, if there was envy, which I'm sure that I agree with you, there must have been, he must have seen the kind of the bickering between the slaves and as Joseph kind of made it to the top of the ranks. And it's curious to me that, I mean, first of all, you know, the scripture says that Potiphar saw that the Lord was with Joseph. And so presumably Potiphar is not a God-fearing man, you know, but he kind of can recognize God when he sees him, kind of a thing. So because he's invested all his household into Joseph, his household is increasing. Then his wife comes up kind of with this cockamamie story. And, I mean, Potiphar stands to lose a lot by making a decision to let Joseph leave because the blessing of God is with him. And, I mean, if he fires Joseph or loses Joseph, then the blessing goes with him, kind of a thing. And I just thought it was curious the level that Potiphar was willing to go to have peace in mm-hmm. his home.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
instead of truth.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was kind of a curious yeah. situation and kind of a desperate situation.
Yeah. It's, as I was thinking about this, it's hard for me to not make a connection between this and, I believe, anti-Semitism. That I think it is the case that God has blessed his chosen people. And one of the forms that that blessing takes is they are capable, talented. Because everywhere the Jews have gone, in various fields of endeavor, they have risen to the top. And that is a situation that is, as we see with Joseph, it's really conducive to envy. People look at that and say, why them? There must be some conspiracy. There must be, why is a Jew at the top of our, and it was, whether it's in culture, in politics, in finance, whatever, why did they rise to the top? And you can see where it's a situation that all it takes is someone to come in and play on that envy, and you can rouse up a lot of passion that can be directed against the Jews. So there's a sense in which their blessing is what brings on them, makes them the targets for envy. And I suspect it's a similar kind of dynamic as we see going on here. And wherever there is that anti-Semitism and the Jews are driven out, it's at great loss to the culture, because they're talented. So I think that this helps explain anti-Semitism. It's the same kind of dynamic that's taking place on a larger scale as to what we see here happening with Joseph. And it's, we want peace at the expense of having them just removed. And it's, I think that we have a number of people in the household who know better. They know that Joseph is not guilty, but they choose to either agree with Potiphar's wife or choose to be silent because they stand to benefit from that, from what happens with Joseph being removed. I think Potiphar is of two minds. I don't think he's entirely convinced that Joseph is guilty here, but what does he do? Does he call his wife a liar? I mean, that's going to be a tough spot to be in. So he decides, I will sacrifice Joseph for the peace in the household. I think that's what Potiphar has chosen to do. Yes. Yes.
Something you said in your opening remarks about truth and lessons learned and whatnot left me feeling a little unsafe about the use of historical narrative. Mm-hmm. There are so many times, especially in the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament, where a narrative is given, and it seems that we human beings have a really difficult time letting narrative be narrative, and choosing to interpret it as not just something that it contains observations, but what you talk about, the homiletic value, is we're supposed to, you know, make judgments and learn lessons and maybe apply them to our lives. I guess I was feeling that there was a little wishy-washiness about moral absolutes. Because when I read the previous chapter we read, I would come away from that observing that everybody did wrong. But it explains how the line of Judah remained intact down to the Messiah. But there's no one to be praised necessarily for their behaviors, and no one is to be complimented for having trusted God or obeyed his moral commandments. Mm-hmm. The first time I encountered this was when people justified polygamy by looking at Old Testament narratives of the patriarchs with their multiple wives. And my observation was, but God never commanded that. The narrative just says they did it. God never commanded, what was her name, Deborah, to drive a stake through the man's head. It just says that she did it. And could you approach the issue of the proper role of historical narrative and the...
Hysterical narrative.
The proper way to handle that. Because if someone were to come to me and say, you know, this woman got cheated out of her inheritance because she never had a son. So what she did, she sneaked into her dead husband's father, you know, and had sex with him and got pregnant with him. Now, because she has these, you know, these bastard children by her father-in-law, well, now she's got her handle on the inheritance, something that her deceased husband's brother wouldn't risk her to have. And boy, wasn't that sharp of her. Now she's got a chunk of change to live off of in her old age. And the Bible says that's the way you should do it, because that's what Tamar did. It just seems to me that no. You know, I mean, kind of look at the issue of historical narrative and it's the moral implications of those observations.
Right. You're right. Historical narrative is rarely prescriptive. That is, it's just describing what happened, but it's not, it's important to keep in mind that both the selection of what's put in there and the way that it is described is God-ordained. I mean, if we believe in the inspiration of Scripture, then it is God-ordained. So there's a sense in which we are seeing things through God's eyes. We're seeing events, how they unfolded from God's perspective. Now, is it tricky then to figure out, to derive from that then, values and principles that one can live one's life on? Absolutely. It is tricky. And so what one has to do is you have to keep going back to, for instance, Genesis, and trying to fill out what is the whole picture that's being painted here. And how does this particular passage fit into that bigger picture? And what is it telling us? And that's a lifetime undertaking. Every time I go through Genesis, I see things that I didn't see before. And the main reason is because I've learned things outside of Genesis in the interim. But then now I'm looking at Genesis with different eyes than I did the last time I went through. But, so you're absolutely right. Historical narrative is very tricky. What I find interesting is a big chunk of the Bible is historical narrative. Why didn't God just lay it out? And I think it's because there is a value that is derived from wrestling with these things and trying to sort it out and put it together as best we can. Now, what you offered as an interpretation of it That's possible. That all it's saying is everybody here blew it big time. But God got his seed through this mess anyway. That could be all it's saying. That all it's saying is everybody here blew it big time. But God got his seed through this mess anyway. That could be all it's saying. The only thing that stops me short there is, what do I do with the statement that Judah makes where he says, she is more righteous than I? Now, you can come back and say, well, that's just his opinion. Or he's not saying righteous, he's saying more righteous. And those both have to be considered. But I still think that what's being described here, what fits best, is someone who is young and doesn't have a very complete understanding of what God requires, is trying to do the best that she can to carry out her duty with respect to her ex-husband and her line, carrying on the line. That may be wrong, but I think that's what's going on.
On a non-homiletic, but rather musical theater sort of note, there is the Andrew Lloyd Webber's production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat that is available on video, which gives a nice overview of this entire story and has some pretty catchy tunes. So just throwing that in there.
Great.
I have a question about what the intention of the phrase made sport of is. When the first time it was used was when Potiphar's wife says to the servants, he brought this Hebrew slave in to make sport of us. And I've always understood that term to mean to make fun of us. Now I'm trying to extrapolate it to maybe humiliate us or something like that. And then she says, when she talks about, makes her claim that Joseph tried to rape her, she actually says, tried to make sport of me. Which I guess goes to his intention. It wasn't that he simply lusted after her and had an itch that needed to be scratched or whatever, but his purpose in doing what he was doing was to humiliate her, just as her husband's purpose in making Joseph his chief steward was to humiliate them. Is that how you would understand that phrase, or what do you think is going on there?
Well, I'm not positive. I would have to look at this again. But I think this is the same word that was used when Ishmael, after Isaac was born, it said Ishmael played with, is one translation, or mocked Isaac. I think it's the same word, and I think it's a similar kind of thing that's being suggested.
So to deliberately humiliate,
yes,
would be a good understanding?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
Why? That's kind of odd. Why would... She's saying something about Potiphar. I mean, I can understand if she was saying that Joseph had evil motives,
right,
wanting to humiliate them, but she's right, actually saying Potiphar did this to humiliate us.
She brought him here to humiliate us.
Right.
So she is placing the responsibility for what happened on Potiphar. So he's got to choose here. I mean, he's to be able to blame here. What are you going to do about it? She's holding him to blame. So I think she's putting the pressure on him. You have to take action here.
But she seemed to be suggesting that the reason he brought Joseph in was to humiliate them.
Uh-huh.
So why would that make any sense?
Why
would he want to humiliate his household, his wife and his household?
I'm not sure. That could be collateral damage, that there's something else that he wants, but this is a side effect of the thing that he wants. What he wants is to prosper. this is a side effect. But I think she's saying it that way because she wants the other people in the household to identify with that. Yeah, we're all being humiliated by having this Hebrew slave over all of us. That's outrageous.
I was just going to make a couple of observations. I happen to be studying the Old Testament right now in another Bible study, and we're looking all through Genesis and the tabernacle and whatnot. In my version, which is a New King James, they use the word mock me instead, and it's used both times by her. And for the lack of a better understanding, there's another side to the issue with the wife. I think she's basically mad at her husband, and she doesn't want to be caught for what she wanted to do. So it just makes you wonder if Potiphar was kind of going up and becoming more wealthy with his household, he probably wasn't paying a lot of attention to his wife. And so he was not only becoming more wealthy, but he was also neglecting his duties. Therefore, you know, we don't know really the heart of her except for, you know, what she does was wrong.
Right.
And the other comment that you made about it being tricky, that's one thing that, I don't know, I don't really kind of agree with that, because I think God really laid it out what we're supposed to do. And I think we spend a lot of time trying to read between the lines that there's not necessarily anything between the lines. It's there. I think he wants us to know how to live. I think it's when our will takes over that we must struggle. And we get in the way of what God's will is for our life. I mean, he gave us a will. So that's where we get into trouble.
There's no question but what that's a factor in it. That does complicate things. But think of something like Abraham being asked to kill his son. That's a tough thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd be able to do it.
how do the principles come? How do they fit here? I don't think I'm supposed to kill, but I've been told to kill my son. What's going on here? So I would argue it is, God did make it tricky. But there's something gained from that trickiness. And that is, when we face those situations, we have to sort it through. And one of the things that comes into play is our own will. And we have to say, is that my will insinuating itself into my thinking, steering me towards the result that I want? Or do I really want what God wants? And having to wrestle that through in every difficult question is a very profitable exercise. And I think that's what God is asking of us. I think that's why he has set things up the way that he has.
Hi. I'm still thinking back on your discussion on Tamar. And I was wondering if you thought there was any significance that she was mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus in the book of Matthew.
Well, I think it is interesting that she is in that line. Exactly what significance to attach to that, I'm not sure. At the very least, it shows, in this story, it shows God's hand at work carrying on his seed. And she plays a role in that. That still leaves open the question as to whether she played a role of being someone doing what is right, or whether she played a role of someone who was doing wrong, but God was still working through it. I think that is still left open. But I think it is important that we see God's hand at work in that chapter, either way. Okay? Thanks.